In 1990, a team of Cambridge scientists on an expedition to Ethiopia noticed a large dead bird that they couldn't identify on a path in Nechesar National Park. They removed its wing and shipped it back to England, where, after much debate, experts decided it belonged to a new species, which they named Nechesar nightjar. 22 years later, Vernon R.L. Head was invited to join a small group of preeminent bird watchers to travel back to Ethiopia to search for that bird. And he writes about that journey and the joys of bird watching in a book called The Rarest Bird in the World, Search for the Nechesar Nightjar. I spoke with him back in March, and we are rebroadcasting the conversation for you on this Labor Day. You've been described as one of South Africa's preeminent bird watchers, but don't you earn your living as an architect?
I do, and I must confess my clients do appreciate that every now and again I will disappear quite quickly.
Is bird watching just a hobby? Is it a challenge for you to balance your work with what seems to be something like an all-consuming hobby, to the point where not just this book, but also you have a collection of poems called The Laughing Dove and other poems all about birds?
When one's in the arts, perhaps as an architect, I think having an interest in the natural world is a wonderful inspiration, and I think perhaps it makes me a better architect. And I do believe that bird watching is perhaps a new way of seeing, particularly a way of seeing the natural world and connecting with it.
And in New York, we have birds who see tall buildings as the equivalent of cliffs.
Indeed.
And they actually just use it as though it were part of the natural habitat.
They do, you know. And cities are just as important for looking at birds as the countryside. And what we try and encourage with bird watching, particularly among the youth, is to go outside and to look at the everyday things.
But there are no professional bird watchers. Did you ever consider becoming a scientist or an academic?
You know, strangely enough, there are many professional bird watchers. The whole bird watching industry is huge. And to give you an indication...
What do they do other than look for birds?
They show other people birds. Mm-hmm. And it's a massive ecotourism industry. Millions of bird watchers all over the world. I mean, one friend of mine, he sold 250,000 copies of his field guide, for example. So people are wanting to look at birds. And what I try and do in my book, apart from telling an adventure story, is try and let people understand the magic of looking at birds and reading the environment when you look at that bird like you would read a book.
Because different birds are attracted to different environments. In fact, that is an important consideration right now, where we are losing some species but just simply because the environments are being destroyed.
Leonard, what we do in South Africa is we have this active campaign of citizen scientists, where we encourage all the bird watchers in the country to look at birds and report where they are and where they are not. And those movements of birds tell us about climate change. They tell us about the movements and changes in our environment, and are actually it's a rather important data.
And the same sort of thing is happening with butterfly watchers.
And frogs. But to give you an indication just how big bird watching is, we're taking some bird watchers out to sea next year off Cape Town, and we've chartered a cruise liner. We're having 2,000 bird watchers on board to go for 5 days out to sea to see the albatrosses of the Southern Ocean. And Peter Harrison, one of the world's most eminent seabird experts, will be there. So we'll share the conservation of our oceans and birds with people.
And are the albatrosses of that ocean all that different from the albatrosses we might find in the Atlantic New York?
The beauty of the albatrosses is their home is the entire ocean. I mean, these things circumnavigate the world. There are about 24 species at the moment, and off South Africa you can get about 10.
How did you come to be invited to join the expedition searching for the Nechesar nightjar?
I've known Ian Sinclair for many years. We've gone on other expeditions together. And if your listeners aren't aware of who Ian is, he's probably Africa's most famous bird watcher and the recipient of the Gill Memorial Medal for Ornithology. He's written 24 books on the birds of Africa. So when he phones you and says, "I have a map with an X that marks the spot of where the wing of the rarest bird in the world was found," you know it's a pretty good map.
Now, the birds of Africa are also often the birds of Europe. And I saw a documentary recently about people in Europe who are trying to protect those birds when they come to Europe, because people catch them.
And, sure.
In many cases, they eat them, but the birds continue to migrate no matter what.
The important thing is that birds don't understand borders. The swallows of Europe come to Cape Town, and if we want to conserve them in Cape Town, we have to conserve them in Europe.
You've dedicated this book to the team that traveled with you to Ethiopia, but also to the scientists who found that bird wing in 1990. Do you know any of the have you met any of those original Cambridge scientists?
Roger Safford and I are good friends. We've spoken regularly. He's given me all his data and all his information that he had when he went on the initial expedition. And they're very excited about what we were able to contribute as bird watchers on our expedition.
How did they explain how that bird had died? And why did they just take the wing?
Well, what happened was it was late one night. They were out on the plain of Nechisar. And if you can imagine this plain, it's probably one of the most remote plains in the world. It's up in the Rift Valley in southern Ethiopia between these volcanic mountains. It's this white grass, and Nechisar is the Amharic word for white grass. So there's this white silky grass and then littered with volcanic pebbles. And you're in the middle of nowhere, a place hardly ever researched. So they were wandering around the plain at night looking for night creatures, as one does that on an expedition.
Isn't that where some fossils have been found?
Well, all kinds of interesting. I think they found a few new damselflies to science and some butterflies, and certainly there are fossils in southern Ethiopia. But when they found this wing, it was squashed into the mud on a smuggler's track. I mean, Hollywood doesn't write stories like this. And they pulled up the wing, and there were a few tail feathers. It was roadkill, really, by a smuggler. And the feathers of the tail blew away, and there was just this one wing left. And what was so exciting about this discovery, it was the first time ever to science that a bird had been described just by a wing. So no one had ever seen it.
And did they suspect when they saw it that it belonged to some unknown species?
Well, they knew it was a nightjar, which are birds of the night, and each nightjar species, the wing is like a fingerprint. The markings on the wing are unique for each species, particularly where there is white or cream. And this bird had this massive white patch on the wing, which shouted something new.
And they nest in the ground, so that makes them susceptible to being roadkill?
Absolutely. These birds nest on the ground, and they are hugely cryptic in nature, so you can't see them during the day.
So they're nocturnal, but why nightjars?
Well, the origins of the name nightjar are not quite clear, but some people say they make this jarring sound in the night.
They're also called goat suckers.
Indeed, and I do mention this in the book, and it's quite an interesting story that because in ancient times in Europe, there was this nightjar, which we know now as the European nightjar, that used to flutter around the edges of villages in medieval times, and it was always seemed to be near the people, but not too close to habitation, and stayed around where the goats were. And they thought that because of the strange shape of its mouth, it used to hang from the teats of goats.
Now, that's how they suckled themselves.
Well, there you have it.
How large do they grow?
If you can imagine the size of a reasonable pizza, that would be the outstretched wings and the kind of size of a nightjar.
How many species have you seen?
I've seen about 20 of the species of Africa. There are a number of species, of course, all over the world, and they vary. One gets nightjars, and then you get things in this part of the world called nighthawks, and more ancient types of nightjars called potus, and then the very ancient one, the oil bird.
My guest is Vernon R.L. Head. We're talking about his book, The Rarest Bird in the World. When they found the wing, didn't they have difficulty shipping it out of Ethiopia?
Absolutely.
Did Ethiopia see this as kind of a natural resource in the way that you might want to hold on to an ancient work of art?
I think Ethiopia has realized the importance of ecotourism, and perhaps there was negotiation afoot to allow this wing to go to the experts at Tring in England for analysis, and that was allowed in the long run. It just took quite a long time to happen.
So where is it on display now?
It's now at the Tring Museum in England, the Natural History Museum.
Okay, so now you're on this expedition to spot nightjars.
Right.
Why was it so difficult? Are there so few? Or are they just
Nightjars or this particular species?
This particular species.
Well,
you want to confirm that there are more of those birds still around.
Right. Well, this information that we got and the map with the X on it was 20 years after the description of the species. And no one had really bothered to go and look for it. I think perhaps the reason is it's such a remote place. I mean, to get there, we had to hire gentlemen with an AK-47 or two. It's not the safest place in the world. One has to negotiate with tribes that have AK-47s in the one hand and spears in the other.
Is this near the Eritrean conflict?
It's about 150 kilometers from Sudan, down in the south of Ethiopia, where you get these very, very isolated small tribes, and they constantly war over grazing land. And I've been on other expeditions down there where we've actually been shot at. And it's not that people are shooting at you. It's just you don't want to get in the way.
So, and in this case, you also have to remain quiet. Birds will fly away even at the slightest sight of something that is strange to them.
Well, you know, the beauty of bird watching is that it's sometimes quite difficult. And looking for the birds of the world, you soon realize that different birds behave differently, and you've got to behave in a certain way to find them in various habitats. And nightjars, it's about using torches and looking for patches of white in the wing at night.
Didn't a colleague teach you how to walk through the jungle without making a sound while you were bird watching in Zambia?
Indeed.
What's the secret?
Indeed. The secret to that is to roll on the sides of your feet as you walk through the what we call the rusting leaves of the Miyambo woodland, to try not to make a noise. And this gentleman, Dennis Weir, who I regard as one of the most skilled bird watchers I've ever met, he's an ex-soldier. He was able to teach me those skills.
Now, here you are in this area that you say is rather desolate. Did you have to get permission to be there at night? Because obviously you have to look for a nightjar at night.
Absolutely. And this is part of the difficulty, because in Ethiopia, you're not allowed into national parks after dark. So we had to do some skillful negotiations to try and get into that park as the sun was going down.
And I would assume beyond the warring local tribes, you'd also have leopards and other animals to worry about.
Let me explain, Leonard, this journey that one takes to get up onto this plane. You have to first drive through a rainforest. There isn't really a road, so you have to drive along the riverbed. The riverbed sometimes has water in it and sometimes not. And what was remarkable about the beginning of the journey was the water had dried in patches, creating salty areas that were filled with tens of thousands of purple, yellow, and green butterflies. So we drove through a river of butterflies, raining up to the sky in the rainforest.
That must have been beautiful.
It was beautiful. But this is bird watching. Bird watching is as much going to the bird as seeing the bird. And then it didn't stop there. Then we had to, after being in the rainforest, wind up this volcanic crumbling hill, which had two calderas, which are collapsed volcanoes on either side, one filled with blue water, one filled with brown, one filled with the biggest Nile crocodiles in the world, and the other filled with the biggest hippopotami in the world, so one didn't want to fall into either of those before one even made it near the plane.
And then you write about keeping your focus. You say, quote, "Not even the wiggling of flying ants and moth-like things trapped in my pants and vibrating in my groin could distract me." But you didn't wind up being able to photograph a nightjar. What happened?
Well, you know, part of the team, we didn't really think we would see the thing. We thought we'd give it a go because we had the information. And when we got up onto that plane that first night, it was well into the night, after we'd seen a number of other species of nightjars, that we suddenly came upon this thing on the ground that lifted up like a giant moth with the hugest white patches in the carpal joints any of us had ever seen. And in fact, the species or the specimen in the museum has got a massive cream patch. So we believe what we saw was a male with an even brighter patch. And this thing lifted up, and we got our torches onto it, and it was gone. So our next decision was, as bird watchers, we knew what we had seen. But this awkward word sort of was put before us, this thing called truth in bird watching. How do we prove what we saw?
And there are people who doubt that there is such a thing?
There always will be without scientific data. But bird watching is about something different to science. And I can talk about that, and I do in my book. But what we then had to do was fashion a way of trying to catch one. And this is something that I talk about as the book goes on a bit.
And I don't want to give away, no spoilers here, but were you disappointed to leave Ethiopia without proof of having seen the bird?
What I can say is that Jerry Nichols, one of the skilled members of the team, was responsible for motivating the local community to create the world's greatest nightjar capturing net, made out of mosquito nets and a long steel pole. And it was from that point that we headed back to see what we could do.
The book that we are discussing by Vernon R.L. Head is The Rarest Bird in the World, The Search for the Nechitar Nightjar. It is published by Pegasus Books, and there's also a collection of poems that you've written about.
It's not available in America yet, but it's just come out, and I'm hoping it's going to do okay.